Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 16th, 2011. The Great Recession has changed a lot about us as Americans, including who declares bankruptcy.
People with college degrees in general, their rates of filing are ticking up. And to me, that was the confirmation that this has been a white-collar recession.
We'll explore America's new debtors. And does the dismal science leave you dazed and confused? Try explaining it on a napkin.
One circle that would say elephant, and another circle that would say dime. Like, an elephant for a dime is only a good deal if you need an elephant and you have a dime.
We'll get out the Sharpie again, this time to explain why we spend to save. Plus, a trendy new way to travel on the cheap.
We specifically have this guest house in our back that we rent it for 5, 10, 15 nights a month.
I think of it kind of like adult youth hosteling.
It's like a house guest who's paying.
Airbnb and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Okay, I'm just going to tell you now, the first part of today's show is, quite frankly, depressing. But as we present the problems, hopefully we'll bring you a few ideas for how to deal with them along the way. This week's sunny job news is that Bank of America is handing out some 30,000 pink slips, 30,000 from the same company. That means lots of folks in the same industry out of work at the same time. And we wondered what happens when you're caught up in a layoff tsunami. Is it even harder to find a job? Possibly easier? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to get some answers.
The waves of layoffs that started during the recession are still crashing on the very rocky shores of our economy. On top of the Bank of America job cuts, Merck will shed up to 13,000 workers over the next few years. IBM has cut hundreds of jobs just this year. Suzanne Graham was unfortunate enough to catch that wave last March.
I was at IBM for 12 and a half years.
Graham was a project manager at IBM's sprawling complex in North Carolina's Research Triangle, overseeing programmers and designers. She worked 12 to 16-hour days. Now she spends her days at home looking for work, shuffling through piles of contacts and job listings.
So, who can I call?
It's a drastic change. Graham says in some ways it's harder to be laid off in a big wave. She's competing for a new job against hundreds of former colleagues. She ran into one at a recent retraining seminar. They're friends and not competitive, but...
I have felt that way with others, though, because I see where, oh, okay, we're competing for the same job.
Graham says lots of tech workers have lost their jobs in the Research Triangle, making the job hunt even more intense. Kevin Halleck is a labor economist at Cornell University. He says mass layoffs are much worse if they're concentrated in one geographic area.
If you are part of a large group in a small area, that could be a real, real problem because if a massive employer, maybe the principal employer in a location, lays off lots of workers at the same time, where are they all going to go?
There is a flip side. At least you're not alone when you lose your job in a big wave. There can be strength in numbers. Wayne Cassio teaches management at the University of Colorado at Denver. He says companies interviewing people laid off as part of a wave know you weren't singled out and fired.
Because people recognize that in many cases, it had nothing to do with your performance. I mean, it may have had to do with a company deciding to eliminate a department.
Or send jobs overseas. Cassio says people should emphasize in interviews that they were part of a large group of layoffs. Suzanne Graham, the former IBM worker, certainly plans to do that. She's also following other advice from experts like Cassio, who say you should be willing to move or even change careers. Graham says she'd enjoy any job that involved teamwork, problem solving, and analysis.
It doesn't matter to me whether it's in the information field, if it's in medicine, teaching. I guess I really need to broaden my search and try a lot of other avenues.
Graham says some of the people laid off with her are helping her do that. They get together for lunch every month or two. They all have different specialties, so aren't after the same jobs. Graham says it's not a pity party, more of a built-in support group.
And, you know, we really help each other out. I run across a lot of things and think about other people who I think would be the perfect candidate for it. So we're acting sort of like a family.
Graham says the key to surviving a layoff wave is finding tidal pools of people you feel comfortable with, who can help you get back on your feet on solid ground. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
When you are out of work, it's easy to fall behind on bills. And for millions of people, that's meant just one option, bankruptcy. A report out this week from the Institute for Financial Literacy shows a surprising new group of people is declaring they are at the end of the rope. Leslie Linfield is the Institute's executive director. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to tell you, the poverty census information came out on, Tuesday. And I was busily tweeting about that and then saw your tweet come across with this bankruptcy information. And I just wanted to bury my head in my hands.
I know sometimes I feel as though I'm the prophet of doom when I'm publishing out our demographics research. It does get a bit bleak.
Well, let's start by talking about some of the basics of this study. What were you looking to learn from it?
We started compiling this data 5 years ago when the bankruptcy law changed. Who files bankruptcy? What does the American debtor look like? And the things that surprised me, definitely educational attainment. You know, there's been this myth that if you go to school and you get the degree, you're somehow going to be protected. Those who didn't go to college, you know, would not fare as well as you would. This myth seems to be eroding. I mean, the majority of people who still file bankruptcy don't have college degrees, but we are seeing that the people with advanced degrees and college degrees in general, their rates of filing are ticking up.
By what percentage?
20% increase in the five-year period.
Wow.
And that's a significant increase.
One of the other standouts, I think, from your study, at least that I noticed, was that there is a new age gap in who is now declaring bankruptcy. Can you take us through that?
We've been watching, you know, and this is one of those, if I could get to the tallest mountain in the country and yell, the population of bankruptcy debtors are older. And this year, the majority of them were suddenly 45 to 54, where for the prior 10 years, they had actually been 35 to 44. And to me, that's alarming.
Why?
Because we have to remember the whole concept of bankruptcy. It's about an economic fresh start, the ability to start over. Now, if I'm 30 and I have to file bankruptcy because things have gotten so difficult, I still have 20 plus years in front of me to start over. If I'm 54, do I really still have the same amount of time in front of me? And that's what I'm fearful of.
Any bright spots that you can point to in this report? I mean, I don't know. Is it possible to have a bright spot in a bankruptcy report? Probably not.
You know, I always try to remind people, bankruptcy was probably one of the first individual rights in the Constitution. We in this country believe in new beginnings, and that's what bankruptcy is about. You know, when I see this and I talk about, you know, this aging population, I want academics and researchers and policymakers to look at this and say, okay, let's find out the root problem here so we can begin to create solutions and, you know, let's make sure these people never have to get here. That is positive.
Leslie Linfield is executive director of the Institute for Financial Literacy. We've been talking about their recent report on the demographics of bankruptcy in this country. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
In some countries, it's even more difficult to declare bankruptcy than it is here. In Spain, if you default on a mortgage, you are still liable for some of that debt. Spain's property bubble burst in 2008, and more than 300,000 families are still paying on homes they don't live in. Lauren Freyer has the story from Madrid.
Rolando and Luda Jimenez lost their jobs, then defaulted on their mortgage. They didn't want their two young children to see them being evicted. So a day before officials came to foreclose on their home, the couple went to their bank to volunteer the keys. Luda burst into tears when she saw a crowd of protesters there to support them.
Rolando, amigo, el pueblo está contigo.
Rolando, friend, your village is with you, they chant, blocking a street in downtown Madrid. These impromptu mobs have become a fixture in Spain. There's an average of 300 foreclosures a day here. Protesters often form a human chain, forcibly blocking officials from evicting residents. Sometimes it turns violent. Foreclosure is a devastating thing for any family to go through, but in Spain it's worse. You still have to repay your mortgage even after the bank takes your home away. It's just too much to bear for Luda Jimenez as she turns in her keys.
You're paying for a house that's no longer yours, that you have to leave, even after you've left. It's not fair.
Many in the crowd here to support the Jimenez family are the same demonstrators who've staged angry rallies across Spain for months over the economy. Now they're targeting Spain's banking system, in which debt is attached to individuals, not assets. Federico Steinberg is an economist at Madrid's Elcano Institute. He says there's no Chapter 11 bankruptcy here where your slate is wiped clean.
The culture of, you know, I made a mistake and I can start again is more difficult.
In Spain, if you can prove that the bank resold your house, you can petition a judge to erase some of your debt. But that process can take years. Protesters like Eva Duncan want the banks to forgive that debt and temporarily halt evictions.
We're asking for answers that don't mean leaving people in the street.
This past summer, the Spanish government tweaked the rules for how mortgage debt is calculated and how much banks can deduct from people's paychecks. Protesters say those changes aren't enough. Jesus Encinar is the CEO of Idealista, Spain's biggest real estate website. He says asking banks to swallow more debt could collapse the whole Spanish economy.
Banks are not charity institutions. They are there to make money and they're there to make the business.
Encinar says Spain never had a subprime mortgage problem. Banks didn't offer irresponsible mortgages. The problem is more than one in five Spaniards is now out of work. They can't afford any mortgage. And Encinar says many buyers did it to themselves. They intentionally overestimated the sale price on their homes to borrow more money from the bank. He says that was like gambling.
Their bet didn't go well. Their houses lost value and now they've lost money. And they want the rest of the economy to save them from the reckless debts that they took. Is that fair? I don't think so.
There is one thing all sides agree on, says protester Eva Duncan.
This was a huge party for a long time, and, you know, long term, that's not possible. And we're getting the hangover from a huge party.
Spain's parliament has named a committee to investigate more mortgage reforms, but its report isn't due till December. By then, 20,000 more families will likely lose their homes. In Madrid, I'm Lauren Freyer for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time to take your money questions. Here to help out this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess.
Well, tell you what, can we talk about the market?
Oh.
Wall Street is just sending people into a tizzy. And, I have been saying over and over again, people, calm down. But,
right.
You know, the fact is when you see the Dow, the S&P 500 making these big moves from day to day. I think a lot of people are starting to ask if this is the new normal. What do you think?
It's a new normal for this period of time that we're in because there is a certain amount of uncertainty. Is Europe going to implode? Is the U.S. going to go into a double dip recession? So some of the uncertainty is fine, although my pet peeve, you look at a headline, market down, fears Europe's going to implode next day. Market up, no more fear, Europe's going to implode.
Next day,
market down, Europe's going to implode. And I'm going, come on, people, it can't be the same story with just a different emphasis.
Exactly. So what are you supposed to do with something like that? I mean, you know, it's easy for us to tell everybody, oh, just ignore the headlines, you're in it for the long run. But you can't ignore headlines these days.
And we do know that there are some serious problems going on, particularly the European sovereign debt issue. You can't ignore that.
Right.
But this is the part that concerns me. When the market's down, we take that as information that something's bad. And we know that any one day you can't pay too much attention to it. But I think that the market is sending off a lot of false signals these days. And here's the reason, Tess. High-speed trading. Now, these are incredibly powerful computers. And they're making trades in 2 milliseconds, taking advantage of a little tiny bit of momentum here, a little tiny bit of momentum there. There's no human judgment at work. So what's the information in what a computer does? That's why we have to be wary.
Wow. So that really just then gets us back to you got to know your fundamentals.
Yes, you have to be educated about the market. But the other thing is most of the time, you can't get too worked up about any one day. You actually can't even get worked up about 1 week. You have to look over a longer period of time and then kind of make your judgments, if it makes sense for you to be making judgments, about what is the market telling us.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones. And Mark is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Tess. Hey, Chris. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
You bet. It's our pleasure. You're in Chapel Hill. You work or attend UNC there?
I do. I'm an undergraduate researcher here in ancient literature.
Ancient literature. So is that like the Dead Sea Scrolls?
It is, yeah. Actually, I wrote an article on the Dead Sea Scrolls last year. I'm working on the Gospel of Luke these days.
Wow.
So is that Aramaic?
A language called Aramaic is kind of a Hellenized dialect of Hebrew. So I do mostly New Testament literature. So I work mostly in Greek and first, second, and third centuries mainly.
So now is that something where you're studying it as literature, or are you studying it as religion?
Ah, well, so it's sort of hard to pull them apart, right?
Sure.
As my advisor says, theology is above my pay grade. So I notably don't do theology, but history of religions and the literature that the religions have produced, there's a lot of theory, both religious and what can it actually tell us about history. It's a fun field. We're in the number one department in the country. Well, joint number one with our arch rivals, which is a school about 8 miles down the road.
We won't mention it.
Yeah, we're gonna leave that.
Except
one.
They have a really good basketball team.
They have the other good basketball team.
Okay. So, what does then Luke say about money?
Maybe in the first century. Not. I found that it hasn't enlightened me too much as to market volatility today.
No.
Maybe dug down deep, there's something about the S&P. I don't know.
Well, I think you need to do the research and then call us back and let us know.
I'll certainly let you know.
So then is there perhaps an ancient money problem that we can help you unravel?
Yeah, well, more of a modern one. I have been encouraged, maybe foolishly, to pursue a PhD in my field. So I'm an undergraduate, and I'm finishing up my final year, and I'm looking at my cash reserves and asking myself, well, how do I pay for this?
Yep. How are you paying for undergrad?
My family puts a very, very high value on education. And so even though we were never particularly wealthy, my family scrimped and saved. And when they found out I was conceived, set up a fund for me.
Wow. So you're not going to have any debt when you leave?
I will not have any debt when I leave. And I will be sitting on probably somewhere around $30,000 that I can play around with. Now,
okay.
I have... It's mostly in stocks and kind of blue chip, stable...
Index funds?
Yes.
Yep.
And I have an advisor who puts a very high value on stability and says, if you're going to need this cash somewhere within the next 2 to 3 years, you should probably be sitting on cash.
Yep.
I like your advisor.
Yep, me too.
I have to say.
So here's my question. I have probably 2 years or so of living funds that I can sit on in cash and be sure that it's there. But I'm sort of intrigued by the market. There's a chance that I could take, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 and put in something a little bit more risky and maybe, you know, in 2 or 3 years, be able to afford an extra year of ramen and library fines.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm young. I feel like I may be able to afford, you know, losing, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 if there's a chance that I can make it a little bit further and not have to work and not have to take out loans.
Oh, I got all kinds of reactions to this.
Yeah, interesting dilemma here, Chris. You know, it certainly seems like he's thought it all out and he's young enough that he could take a risk, but it is money, you know. I mean, I suppose if you're willing to just lose $4,000 or $5,000, then that's up to you, but I wouldn't want to.
I mean, part of it is to, you know, really think about what it would mean to lose $4,000 or $5,000. Now, you probably wouldn't go absolutely to zero because with a PhD program, you should be getting grants. I would imagine you'd be doing some TA, being a teacher assistant. So you will be having some income coming in.
Yes.
So what this money is doing, it's a little bit of a safety valve. I'd really be interviewing, talking to PhD students? What is their experience? What is their financial experience? How much loans are they really taking out? Or in your case, you won't be taking out because you're going to have the savings. And, you know, come up over the next 5 to 7 years with a financial plan.
Do I throw it in something a little bit?
So are you talking about putting that money back into, say, another index fund that perhaps is all stocks? Or are you talking about buying some individual company stocks, taking probably a lot more risk?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at doing some research into some startups or some more depressed stocks and waiting, you know, 2 or 3 years and see if I can get, you know, 15% on it instead of the 3.5 or 4% that I'm going
to
get.
Yeah, so you're really wanting to take quite a big risk with the money.
Yeah,
right.
So, you know, there's this expression. There's a wonderful behavioral economist. He wrote this paper years ago. I just always love the title, Trading is Hazardous to Your Wealth. When you're trading, when you're going to higher risk stuff, it's just an axiom of finance that taking greater risks, yes, you create that opportunity for a greater return, but it also means you create an opportunity for a greater loss.
Right.
You're going into a graduate program. There's going to be a lot of pressure on you to come up with your PhD. And so how much time are you really going to have to devote to picking out a stock?
Right. That's a good point. I'm not going to have a huge amount of time to be sitting in front of the screen and, you know, and doing day trading. And
basically, go the conservative route. If you want to take a little bit of money and have a flyer on it, that's okay. But keep it small and be realistic about it.
Okay.
That was ancient wisdom from Tess and Chris.
Get some papyrus, bury it in the sand somewhere, and in about 50 years, we're going to have a great discovery.
Fantastic. I like it. All right. Well, good luck with your studies.
All right. Hey, thanks so much.
All right. Let's go next to Jane in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Tess.
How are things in the Big Apple? What do you do there?
I'm in marketing with a major consumer magazine publishing house.
Can you tell us what that is?
That would be Condé Nast.
Ah, Condé Nast. Yes. Oh, so you're hanging out with Anna Wintour?
Yeah, we're besties.
Does she have any besties?
She's an extraordinary woman. I'm privileged to have been able to work with her.
Really? You've actually worked with her side by side?
It was my first post with the company many years ago, not long she started as editor-in-chief.
How exciting. And this, of course, is a big week for all of you, Fashion Week.
Yes. Happily, I am a bit removed from that runway fray.
The madness,
I don't miss it at all, yes. The closest I get is the Twitter feed.
Speaking of Twitter feed, I remember a few weeks ago, the Condé Nast elevator had a feed.
Yes. In fact, there are those in the building who were convinced it was me.
And was it?
No.
Yes.
I can say emphatically right here on the radio that I was not Condé Nast elevator.
I would love to talk to the Condé Nast elevator sometime. So if you're out there somewhere, feel free to give us a call. Well, what can we help you with? If it is a fashion question, Chris can't help, but I might be able to.
You're right about that.
Hey, for fashion and style, I think I'm okay. But here's my scenario. I am happy to say that, fingers crossed, I'm getting toward the end of a refinance process for a new family home.
Congratulations.
So here's the little kicker. Right before I submitted my application, I agreed to co-sign a federal student loan for my goddaughter, who is headed off to her first year actually at a university overseas.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
I do not undertake any financial commitment lightly. I'm only the co-signator, but I undertook that obligation with the expectation that if, God forbid, everything goes south, that would not be a hardship for me in any way and something that I'd be happy to do.
So you went into it with eyes open.
Yes. That said, I was a little bit surprised to learn that my potential refi application considered that loan as though I had taken out that loan directly myself.
Yep.
I believe that's not going to affect the loan being approved. My question is really, I pride myself on having a very good credit score. It's one of the things that's enabled me to lock in this rate, but I think I'm going to be taking a hit.
How much money are we talking about?
$13,000.
Okay. And you're aware of it, but just for everyone who's listening, it is important to realize that when you co-sign a loan, it is treated as if you have taken out that loan. My feeling is that whatever impact, there will be something of a negative impact, but it's going to be fairly small.
What is your current credit score?
813.
Oh, so you're still going to be well within awesome range.
And how long does it take before it comes back up?
Why do you care? Can I ask that?
That's
pretty much anything above, what is it, Chris, these days? 750, 760?
Say 760.
So 760 and above, it doesn't matter if it's 770 or 840.
Oh, okay.
You're absolutely fine. And by the way, just what you described, this doesn't sound like this loan really changes your overall financial picture very much. I mean, and Tess really hit on this, is, you know, after a certain point, it really doesn't matter. It's not a report card.
Can you tell I was the one who wanted to do the extra credit work?
Yes. Yes, I can.
But at least when you do extra credit in school, you might get something for it. You do extra credit with your credit report. And as I said, beyond like a 770, it doesn't matter. But there are people, in fact, there are people in my very office who like to go around bragging that they have an 850. And for whatever reason that is, I don't know. But
I don't know. That's a little like walking around with your SAT score. Of course, I wouldn't tell mine, but that's a different story.
This is very reassuring, guys. Thank you. I appreciate the help.
Oh, you're most welcome. And let us know when you close that refinance, because we like to hear that kind of good news here.
I will. I'll follow up.
Thanks a lot, Jane.
You got it. Bye now.
All right, and finally, let's go to Melissa in York. Oh, South Carolina. We already had North Carolina. Now we've got South Carolina. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm hanging in there.
Yeah? What do you do there in York?
I work in the theater, actually. I'm a stage manager. Very fun. Not very lucrative, but very fun.
So you tell people when to exit stage left and right?
Yes, and then I turn the lights out on them if they don't.
Oh, yikes. So you said it's not terribly lucrative, though, for you.
No.
Is this a difficulty for your finances, then? Are you having trouble making ends meet?
It is. I mean, I'm living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
I have a lot of debt. Before I worked in the theater full-time, I had another day job, and then I lost that in early 2008.
And when you say you have a lot of debt, what are we talking about?
About $10,000.
Okay.
Which I know is small to what some people have, but, you know.
No. It's still debt. It's still a burden.
It is still.
And, you know, and I don't own a house, and I'm not making a car payment, and I don't have student debt, so that's all credit card living expense.
Yeah, so when you say you're living paycheck to paycheck, that means that sometimes you're having to put basic living expenses on a credit card?
Right.
Yep. Well, unfortunately, Chris, I think a lot of folks can relate to this right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so many people are living barely, pulling things together, stitching it together.
Yep.
I mean, if you look at the national figures, about 25 million people are unemployed or underemployed.
Right.
Right.
So what specific question can we answer for you?
Well, what I'm trying to figure out is it better for me to pay off my credit card first and then start building up a savings, or build savings while I'm doing the credit card? Or, I mean, and how do I do that when I'm living paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah, do you have any leftover income? It doesn't sound like it.
Well, what I've done is I have a budget spreadsheet that I use every month.
Good for you.
So I get paid weekly, and so I always budget for 4 weeks, which means that on the months when there are 5 paydays, I have a little bit of flex room there, but not every month has 5 weeks.
Okay.
Right.
This is one of those situations. I mean, I have a very strong sense about how you should be going about doing it. But, you know, it's so easy to say. In a more ideal world, you would have about a couple hundred dollars worth of savings.
Right.
And then the rest goes toward debt. Once you add that couple hundred dollars. And the reason for the couple hundred dollars is so that when something unexpected does come up, you don't have to use the credit card again.
Right.
And then once you've got a couple hundred dollars in savings, then whatever extra money you have, and I know it's not much, then goes toward paying down that credit card debt.
Okay.
Melissa, you do need to make sure that you're paying at least the minimums, though.
Right.
So that you don't get behind.
What I've been doing is on the first of the month, I'll go ahead and pay off the minimum and then send a couple other checks throughout the month of, you know, a couple hundred dollars here, a couple hundred dollars there.
Right.
Yeah.
So frustrating and embarrassing. And I mean, I feel like I'm much smarter than my finances make it look like I am.
Oh, you know what?
Well, you are. I mean,
there are so many people who are exactly in the same situation. And don't feel bad about yourself about it. You know, it is what it is. But at least you're thinking about it.
Right.
You're not putting it in the drawer, which a lot of, I mean, believe me, a lot of people do.
Right.
I mean, they just take that statement, you know, they just sort of go, well, I'll get to that. And 3 weeks later, they still haven't gotten to it. So now I think you're well ahead. And the other thing I was thinking of, you know, this is a hard time because of high unemployment rate, but sort of using this time also while you're paying down this debt and adding to your savings about thinking about, you know, trying to come up with some sort of business plan, you know, personal business plan for the next 5 years.
So that,
you know, put yourself in a position where, okay, here's what I want to be doing. Then what realistically can I do and how can I boost my income and sort of use this time to build a better career path for yourself. And the whole thing about business plans, which every small business person will tell you, you change it year two or year three. But it sort of might put you also on a path where you feel, okay, right now it's really tough, but I kind of got an idea where I'm going. And in year three or year four, it's going to get better.
Yeah.
And don't get down on yourself for not doing everything perfectly in your financial life, because none of us do.
Well, no. That helps.
It's really true.
Including me and Chris, right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, well, thank you very much. I feel a lot better.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm so glad.
Good
thanks
luck.
For the call, Melissa.
All right, thanks.
All right, if you've got a question of your own, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell that M-O-N-Y. Or shoot us a note, go to our website. It's marketplace.org and type in Getting Personal in the search box. Chris, thanks so much. Great to talk to you again.
It was great, Tess. Thanks.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. This next story could be the answer to some of your money woes. If you've got a spare bedroom, maybe a guest house in the backyard, some cash-conscious travelers may be willing to pay you to stay there. However, I should mention that you also have to be okay with having strangers in your personal space. Well, I've got some folks in the studio here who've got experience on both sides of the transaction using a service called Airbnb. First, our friend Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Hey, Ron.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Crystal and Justin Bradshaw. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
And you all know one another quite intimately.
Well, we do now.
Well, we do now, yeah. That's a good way to put it.
So Ron stayed with you guys through one of these services. Ron, how did you find him?
Well, I was looking for some place to stay in the south part of the San Fernando Valley when I was in town for a family funeral. I did not want to spend $250 at the Courtyard by Marriott, mm-hmm. and I figured there had to be a better way. And I had seen all the buzz, both positive and negative, about Airbnb. On one hand, you know, you can rent somebody's room or somebody's guest house for under $100. On the other hand, hosts were having problems where their apartments were being completely trashed by renters. And I thought, this is a phenomenon I want to get in on. So I felt like I had to experience this.
Justin, why would anyone in their right mind rent out a room to a total stranger?
Well, it's a great way to make some extra money.
Yeah.
We specifically have this guest house in our back that we used to rent to a full-time person.
Hmm.
But when we were thinking about having a baby, we decided to rent it out part-time. And so now we can rent it for, you know, 5, 10, 15 nights a month instead of 30 nights a month, and we get to use it sometimes.
So, Crystal, how did you decide that this would be something that you would be comfortable with?
Well, I'd say I'd become kind of like an expert at screening out the weirdos. So
that would be the number one concern,
that's the number
it?
One concern. At first, it was a little strange on Airbnb because you don't get somebody's phone number. You're just communicating back and forth via their website, and they don't allow you to exchange that information.
So you looked at Ron's profile and decided he wasn't a weirdo.
Yeah, and we saw the New York Times. We're like, oh, he's probably okay.
Ron, talk about what the experience was like. Had you ever done anything like this?
No, nothing at all. It was very unusual. And 24 hours or something went by, and I thought, huh, maybe I'm not even going to see them. But then I think I woke up the second morning. It was very early, and I was going for a hike. And there you were in the window. I don't think you had a shirt on. And it looked like you had just woken up, and you're there at the Mac.
He's speaking of Justin, by the way.
Awkward!
Right. So there was Justin, you know, shirtless in the window. And there I was. And we made eye contact. And I'm thinking to myself, is this the part where I'm supposed to go and say hello? But he doesn't really look like he wants anybody to come say hello. Maybe he hasn't had his coffee yet. Yeah.
So here's where we get into, you know, are there kind of unwritten rules, assumptions that you make in a situation like this? Or are they written rules?
I think they're more unwritten.
But Airbnb does allow hosts to post house rules,
yes.
Right?
Yes, mm-hmm. We can do that. That's true. I always like to ask my guests, you know, please tidy up after or when you're done, because you are staying in someone's house. It's right. Different than a hotel, and a lot of people don't get that if they've never done this type of thing before. It's really your home, so the etiquette should be a little bit different when you come and stay.
It's like a house guest who's paying. Kind of. Yeah. That's kind of, I would say, the best way to describe it. And you would...
And
you
as
would,
a total stranger.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the big difference there.
Yeah.
But everybody's been wonderful. I've met some really great people. I think of it kind of like adult youth hosteling.
Huh.
Because a lot of people are travelers, and you get to talk to them, meet people from all over. I really enjoyed it.
Was I supposed to make the bed? I think
No. He's just teasing.
I think I asked whether I could strip it or not.
No, you were fine. You left the place in great condition.
Okay,
it was
good.
Absolutely. Fine.
It's also important to point out one of the things that makes Airbnb a success is the social aspect of being able to review people and being able to post your profile and have some sort of kind of like eBay allowed you to sort of build up some trust,
right,
and create a reputation for yourself.
You get like a rating?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk brass tacks here. Ron, what did you pay to stay with these guys?
Between $80 and $85 a night, I think.
Okay, and then so significantly cheaper than staying in a hotel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was a bargain as far as I was concerned. And then there's a fee tacked on top of that.
10%.
That goes to Airbnb.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
Also, Airbnb charges us a 3% credit card processing fee.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like it was a good experience all the way around, at least in this room. So, Ron, would you recommend it as a general rule, as long as you're paying attention to who you're staying with?
I'm absolutely going to do it again. I mean, one of the highest and best uses for it, you know, beyond just looking to save money as a person traveling by yourself, is if you're with a family. You know, there's not that many one-bedroom hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems like, a good way, as is VRBO.com and others. But, you know, I like the social aspects of this. I like the fact that it feels kind of Web 2.0. It just feels more trustworthy in that sense. And I like the idea of maybe using it to rent out an entire apartment or a small mm-hmm. house when traveling with family for like a week as opposed to a night or two.
All right. And it's been good for you guys.
Yeah.
Nice, tidy little extra income there, too.
Definitely.
All right. Crystal and Justin Bradshaw have been joining us, and they have a room available for all of you in their San Fernando Valley here in Los Angeles. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Great.
And Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist at the New York Times, a good friend of the show.
A pleasure.
Good to see you again.
As always.
The latest battle for your dollars comes courtesy of the ever-multiplying number of daily deal sites. Groupon, Living Social, Gilt, Social Buy, Eversave, yada, yada, yada. They offer these discount coupons on everything from meals to shoes to massages. And that can drive even the most excited bargain shopper to proclaim, enough is enough, as commentator Christina Wong has done.
I'm a recovering Groupon-aholic. This year, 2/3 of my credit card charges will be for group buying websites like Groupon, Living Social, or one of their copycat competitors. I eat, groom, and snorkel all via these discount vouchers that I usually buy in bouts of late-night web surfing insomnia. I knew my hoarding hit an all-time low when I found myself at a Galaxy game. Apparently, Los Angeles has a professional soccer team. I'm not a soccer fan, but that $15 deal for the sideline ticket, beer, and Galaxy hat had me willing to spend it like Beckham. I wish I could practice consumer monogamy with all the lovely businesses I've met via GroupBuy websites. I feel guilty that small businesses have sacrificed their profits to woo me into a long-lasting commitment, that even the businesses that have impressed me will never know me as more than a one-night stand. For I'm part of a new subculture of Groupon hussies. I want to commit, but I get my fix from tramping all over town wherever a discount will have me. Can you blame me for strumpeting in and out of desperate businesses in all my cheapskate glory when the Groupon craze has made it possible to never pay full price again? You know, though, the explosion of Groupon-esque websites may actually be both the impetus and end of my discount voucher hoarding days. The market is now oversaturated with more than 200 Groupon clones nationwide. The flurry of deals makes it seem like there's a fire sale on every block. And with the evolution of real-time deals, it's too overwhelming for addicts like me to feel the pressure to buy Groupons the way I used to. There's only so much French food, yoga, and horseback riding I can consume in a day. I'm growing numb to high discount margins and the timer ticking down to the end of a great deal. Because I know a simple truth. If I miss out on a great buy on some other discount site, that discount will come back around.
Christina Wong is a writer and a stand-up comedian living here in Los Angeles. So what is it about these Groupon, coupon, boupon things that makes us all so willing to buy stuff that we might not otherwise? Well, because plain and simple, we are suckers for a deal. And to explain that particular phenomenon, we brought back Carl Richards, founder of Prasada Capital Management in Park City, Utah, and our intrepid art on the radio guy. You've seen his drawings in the New York Times Bucks column where he takes an economic term or an idea, gets out a Sharpie, and illustrates it on a napkin. Welcome back, Carl.
Hi, Tess.
So we have spoken to you several times now about the sketches that you've done, but I wondered if you were game to try one for us today.
Yeah, that's some serious pressure, but let's give it a shot.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the issues that we deal with all the time on this show is the notion of spend to save. And this can be something as big as, oh my goodness, interest rates are at historic lows, so because of that, I'm going to go buy a house. I'm going to use that rationale as a decision to go and get my house now, because otherwise I'm going to miss out. Or it can be something as simple as they have dresses on sale today at Macy's. So even though I don't really need a dress, I'm going to go get one because I'm going to save money on it. Spend to save. Go.
I've had this discussion a lot with a family member who does the same thing, right? We'll buy 50 bars of chocolate because they're on sale, even though she doesn't need 50 bars of chocolate. And what just popped into my head would be a circle. And it's an old saying that we could just capture in a drawing. One circle that would say elephant and another circle that would say dime. And so if you think of this as like a traditional Venn diagram, I call them circle sketches. And where they overlap, it would say only a good deal if you need an elephant and you have a dime. Maybe like that old statement that like an elephant for a dime is only a good deal if you need an elephant and you have a dime. So buying a new house because the interest rate deduction is going to go away or interest rates are low is only a good deal if you need a new house and you've got the money to make the mortgage payment.
Yeah. So as you're drawing this, any insights as to why this is such a common behavior?
I like to think a lot about the sort of genetics because a lot of what we do may make perfect sense genetically and it just may not be rational. Like we're just not sort of set up for it. So I think maybe there's some sort of hoarding issue going on, like this idea that, hey, something's going to be gone. I better get it while it's still here.
So we're afraid we're going to miss out.
Yeah, sure. Afraid we're going to miss out. Afraid we're making a bad decision, right? The fear of regret is a big motivator. And we, all of us, hate to look back and say, I wish I would have done that. And that may play a huge role in it, too.
All right. So we've got our overlapping circles now and our elephant and our dime.
That's right.
All right. Well done, Carl Richards. We challenged you and you rose to the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see if I could. I don't know that that could ever be repeated at home. Don't try this at home.
Okay. And we will have a photo of Carl's napkin, his special Marketplace Money napkin drawing on our website. It's marketplace.org. Carl, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
So much for getting a good deal on education at a state school. Good Lord. This week, the University of California laid out a budget plan that could raise tuition, just tuition, to more than $22,000 by the 2015 school year at a state school.
So what if you could get the benefits of college, at least some of them, without the price tag? Well, Anya Kamenetz is a senior writer for Fast Company and the author of the new free ebook called The EduPunk's Guide to a DIY Credential. Anya, what's the problem with college?
Well, the problem is that there are millions and millions of people out there who want access to a college education, who have the ability to take advantage of a college education, but they do not have that access, either because of money, because of time, because of other responsibilities. And that's who this guide is for.
So essentially, you're just saying, look, college does not have to be the only option for you to be a success in your life. But haven't we known that all the way along?
Well, we may know that in our hearts and in our minds, but the fact is, in this economy, it is very, very hard to join the middle class without some kind of credential past high school. And there just isn't enough capacity in our public systems. They have been dealing with year after year of budget cuts. And, you know, there's not a lot of resources out there. So I think that people need to start figuring out other paths to get that degree.
What exactly is involved in that DIY degree? I mean, what do you do for it, and what do you get out of it?
So what I'm encouraging people to do is put together a personal learning plan, which includes their personal goals. And once you've determined what it is that you want to do, it may be that you want to get a certification or a license, which could mean taking a private course or taking a course at a community college and then sitting an exam and passing an exam. If you want to get credit for your life experience, you can put together a portfolio. And there's a national program called learningcounts.org, which shows you how to do a six-week class to put together a portfolio, which is a narrative of your learning that you've gotten from military training or job training or volunteering or traveling, and put that all towards a degree. And then there are colleges and universities like Excelsior, Empire State, Charter Oak State College. And these are all public universities that specialize in helping people take their prior learning experience and put them towards a personally designed learning plan.
Let me play devil's advocate here, though. You know, a DIY credential is nice and all, but you've got this incredibly cutthroat job market out there right now. How is this going to help someone make the cut to stand out against someone like you, a Yale grad, someone who went to a state school, a community college even?
I think that the key ingredient is that individuals are taking charge of their own learning, and they're connecting their goals within the classroom to a goal outside the classroom. And that's why the guide includes tutorials for people to start to create and build their personal learning network, to find a mentor, to connect to a community. People are not getting hired because of a paper resume or because of their transcript or their diploma. They're getting hired because they can demonstrate value.
But that doesn't sound true. I mean, I feel like we are actually hearing the opposite, that if you don't have a resume and an education that is going to make you stand out from everybody in the field, it's just going to get dumped in the trash. I mean, it's so competitive.
Well, what does it really mean to stand out? I mean, I profile, for example, a community of programmers called GitHub. And GitHub was started just as a place for people to collaborate on open source software projects. And the languages that are being used in that community to program in, languages like Python, Java, PHP, these are not being taught in our computer science programs. Our computer science programs can't keep up. And there are companies like Twitter and Apple that are recruiting directly off of GitHub. And you know, this is really the new credential. You know, a resume is a dead piece of paper unless you can connect it to something that really demonstrates what you can do and how you can do it. You know, a credential is nice, it's important, but it is not sufficient anymore.
Anya Kamenetz is the author of the new e-book, The EduPunk's Guide to a DIY Credential. She's also a senior writer for Fast Company magazine. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to York, South Carolina, with a little help from Pink.
So frustrating and embarrassing. You know, I mean, I feel like I'm much smarter than my finances make it look like I am.
Melissa, our caller from earlier this hour, you may not be perfect with your finances, but you are doing really smart things to help yourself. So I, the pig, and Pink say bravo. Feed Piggy as best you can, and he'll try to return the favor. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me too on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, interest rates low, consumer spending down. Should be a great time to buy a used car, right?
I mean, let's face it, the country is still in an economizing frame of mind, and that's definitely driven the prices up.
Oh, is nothing sacred anymore? Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.